My name is Wanda Deifeld, and I'm from Brazil. I'm a pastor of the Lutheran Church. I teach at Lutheran Seminary in the city of São Leopoldo, which is in the southern part of Brazil. Although I have worked extensively in the whole country. Our subject this evening is the influence of liberation theology in Latin America. And I know that there are some people here who also have done a considerable amount of work and have had a lot of contact with other countries in Latin America that I have only known of or read of. So please feel free to share your own experiences with this, because I think it's, for many of us, it is a chapter in our own personal history. So please feel free to share that experience as well if you so find appropriate. And do not hesitate to interrupt and make questions or comments, because I think this is very much the way that we do theology in Latin America. We do not do it ex cathedra, speaking, you know, like I'm the one who has the authority, but it's very dialogical, it's very relational, and it's very much focused on the questions and the concerns of the people themselves. Many of my colleagues who are theologians, they said, well, especially a theologian like Clodovis Boff, he said, well, theology has this vice. It's addicted to responding to questions that nobody has made. And so I don't want to fall into that trap, because many times theology has been so concerned in answering questions that nobody has posed that it has lost sight of what is really important. So, hi. This evening I would like to share with you a book of poetry by one of the bishops, now deceased, called Dom Helder Câmara. I have seen his last name pronounced in different ways. Some people say Camara or Camara. It's, in Portuguese it's Câmara, so the closest I think pronunciation would be like that machine that takes pictures, you know, camera. I think would be maybe the closest way of doing it. And I would like to intertwine my observations also with that poetic note. Bishop Dom Helder Câmara died a couple of years ago, and as a person of very, very short stature, he was also a great personality. And my husband had the opportunity of working with him and his congregation. Very ecumenical, open to receiving people from other denominations. And I worked also in the Amazon area with Bishop Dom Pedro Casal D'Aliga, who is still one of the best known bishops, liberation theologians in Brazil at this point. So I share a lot of experiences, my own life, but also a very strong commitment to a cause that goes beyond my own work, but I think has to do with the cause of Jesus and with the witness in favor of those who are outcast, who are excluded from society. I want to begin with by reading one of Dom Helder Câmara's poems and showing you what liberation theology I think is all about. He says, let every word be the fruit of action and reflection. Reflection alone, without action or tending towards it, is mere theory, adding its weight when we are overloaded with it already. And it has led the young to despair. Action alone, without reflection, is being busy pointlessly. Honor the word eternal and speak to make a new world possible. Liberation theology started in Latin America in the 1970s. already in the 1960s, as a result of the Second Vatican Council, which finished in 63, and that represented a very strong opening within the Roman Catholic Church to social issues. You know that those were the years in which the Roman Catholic setting, a lot of discussion was being raised whether masses should cease to be in Latin or whether they should take the language of the people themselves, something that in the Protestant church we had experienced, you know, almost 500 years beforehand, but that was happening in the Roman Catholic setting. And also very strong commitment of being, that Christianity should be a religion that makes a difference in the world. And I think that has to do in Latin America with appropriating what the church was saying, in that case, Roman Catholic Church, and in a context in which Roman Catholicism is and was and still is the predominant religion, that represented a major shift in the way the church also portrayed itself. Of course, the situation that Latin American countries live nowadays is very much a reflex of colonial times, in which during 500 years we have lived under first the domain of the Spanish and the Portuguese, and then the British, their true commercial influence, and nowadays in a globalized world, as you well know how it goes. In Latin America, poverty is a daily reality. It's estimated that 60% of the population live with less than $1 a day. It's estimated that in Brazil alone, 40% of the population is landless, meaning to say has no access to appropriate housing or how to produce their own food. The majority of the people live in poverty itself, or even a significant number among the poor live beyond poverty level, but would be considered by the United Nations as beyond poverty level. That's a new reality for us. We talk about poor, but now we know that even poverty, as we used to know it, is getting to the point that we're talking about misery. People who are living in garbage dumps, people who are homeless in the streets. And that's not only a situation in Latin America, it's a situation all over the world. And you know that if you only look at the newspapers, if you only watch TV, and you see how that is spreading all over the world. We are becoming richer and richer. Brazil is one of the countries that is a very rich country, I should say. It is not a poor country, but it is a country that has many, many poor people. Why is that so? Because we have lived always in a situation in which government has privileged those who have and never looked for the interests and assuring the well-being of the have-nots. So on the one hand, in the disparity between rich and poor is so, I will give you one simple example. About 80% of the privately owned land, meaning to say the land that is not federally owned, not by the state, I mean national parks and things like that, 80% of the land that is privately owned is in the hands of less than 10% of the population. So you can imagine the gap between people who have a lot, people who are flooded by wealth, and the amount of people who have absolutely nothing at all. I did part of my practical work in the Amazon area, and part of the experience that was really shocking to me, because I was born and I was raised in the southern part of Brazil, land, farming land, in which we had many small properties, like a family could live in a small property. My father's and my mother's generation was the first one that did not have enough land for its children. So my father and his brother had to look for a job elsewhere because the land was too small to be able to be divided once more. And so one son stayed and the two others had to work in factories or look for other jobs. The same thing with my mother's family. One father stayed and others have to look for something else to do. And then working in the Amazon area and having this as my background, I was shocked in traveling by bus in one of the dirt roads of in the fringes of the jungle. And at 9 o'clock in the morning, you're coming into this huge fence with a sign saying, this is the property of such and such a person. And then by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you would still have the same fence. It would still be in the same property of that one family. And that is something that we inherited from colonial times. You know, when the Portuguese and when the Spanish came, they just divided the land and gave it to different governors. And the governors would be the ones entitled to getting the revenues and the riches out of that land and then exporting it to Portugal or to Spain. Well, that meant already a very uneven distribution of land. And I'm not talking about not entering the issues of the indigenous people and of slavery per se, which were very sad chapters in the history of Brazil, the same way as it is in the history of your own country. But that already meant that the land was distributed unevenly. And nowadays we have states that are practically the property of still that one same family. So the land is distributed unevenly. I wanted to say that there is one magazine out in the racks that deals with dollars and cents. I think it's one of the magazines out there. I didn't dare to bring it because I was tempted to bring it to show it to you, but I thought lightning would strike at me because, you know, the war is about don't you dare to remove anything from there are so strong. But it has on its cover a very interesting, and it develops a very interesting article in this magazine talking about the uneven distribution of land and what the poor people have to deal with.
Is it true? I'm not sure. That was in, like in Rio de Janeiro, they have a community, you know, on the hillside there, and they have to govern themselves. They just sort of threw them off by themselves.
Yeah.
They govern themselves and everything. It's hard when you're already in poverty.
What happened, especially in the large cities, and that's not only true of Rio de Janeiro, but it's true of all the major cities in Brazil, there is a poverty belt built around the cities. The downtown area is the area where the rich people live. And then there is this misery belt that was built around it, at the fringes of the cities. And these are of very, very poor conditions. And in the large cities, these are called favelas, shanty towns. And the favelas, especially in places like Rio de Janeiro, Salvador, Recife, you name any of the large cities, but São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro would be the main ones. These were the drawing places for people who were migrating from the countryside, who were expelled by the large landowners, and you know, they just didn't have any land to work on. So they were working practically as slaves for these large landowners. And then coming to the big cities in the hope of, you know, the expectation of finding a land where they would have abundance, they would find jobs. Well, that happened in part, but many times also it meant living in very rough conditions. But if you ask any person who lives in a shantytown, the majority of them will say they would rather stay in the cities, living in those conditions, than going back to the countryside where there are no conditions at all. So that's why land reform is such a very important political issue. Well,
is it also true that you got these little pockets of favelas, that there's no pavement or anything?
Yeah.
Like there is,
well, right now, in this, if you have seen any news, and I find it so frustrating to find any information about Brazil, because apparently all of South America and Latin America does not exist in official news. It's like, you know, we are just, you know, so many people living there, but you know, it's not important. And what I find frustrating is the lack of information in the mostly you'll find the news about Colombia and the war on drugs and the narco traffic. But what's happening right now in Brazil, especially in Rio de Janeiro, where you have huge sections of the city that are completely out of control. The police doesn't dare to go in, you know, because of the drug traffic and the situation that was made unbearable by poverty itself. The poor people say, we can't rely on the drug cartel, on the drug traffickers, because they will not hurt us. We need to be afraid of the police. And I think I need to share something with you related to the history of most of the Latin American countries, which is a strong suffering and pain that many of us have gone through via military dictatorship. I don't know how many of you are connected to military or to police, or but in Brazil, because we lived under a dictatorship where any of our civil rights were cut. I mean, we had no freedom of expression. We had no freedom to meet. And many of my friends were tortured by the police. We have a lot of reservations when it comes to police in the military. I'm always so surprised to see police men or police women in this country, you know, like kids are attracted to policemen, police women. Everybody wants to be a police, nobody wants to be a thief. And you know, police, as at the scene I saw the other day, it's like a policeman just, you know, taking a kid and holding a kid. It's like, I was, a policeman with a kid. It's like, it's built in, and, you know, this reservation that we have, and that for you, it means safety. It's, you know, like this family type of relationship that you have with the police, and we are so afraid of the police, you know. They are there to torture you. And many of my friends did indeed go to jail. They were tortured, and some of them have wounds and scars still today. I want to read another poem by Dom Helder Câmara, as he was addressing precisely the rich people in the congregations, because the same people, especially in the Roman Catholic setting, the same people who are the large landowners are members in the churches where the landless people are from. So how can you live in the very same congregation with the two opposite sides, and as they fight for their what they consider their rights? And Dom Helder was one of the people, along with all the others that I've mentioned here, Gustavo Gutierrez, Leonardo Boff, and Clodovis Boff, Rubem Alves, and Pablo Richard, who has taken the side of those who are poor and those who are outcast. And this is one of his poems. If you want to be free of yourself, you must build a bridge over the gulf of loneliness your selfishness has found, and look beyond. Listen to another, and especially try loving him or her and not just me. You want to be, excuse me, first get free of that excess of goods which cram your whole body, leaving no room for you and even less for God. And one of the things that the liberation theology did, and the first theologian to actually use the term liberation theology in his writing, was Gustavo Gutierrez, even though a Protestant theologian, a Presbyterian named Rubem Alves, had done so beforehand, even though he did not publish any book with this title. So we are indebted to Gustavo Gutierrez for naming this theology. And it was developed in a very particular, which I find a very unusual and an innovative method. And we call it in Portuguese, ver, julgar, agir, or to see, naturally down here, to judge or to discern, and then to act. And the interconnectedness between these three elements is what presents a novelty for this theology. Liberation theology has been very influential also in other parts of the world, and also in the United States. And I think this method of theory and praxis of action and reflection has been appropriated by many other theologies since. If you think about the Minjun theology in Korea, for instance, that has a very similar approach. If you think about the African theologians, especially those that are committed to the South African liberation movement, the Kailas document, and all of these theologies represent, I think, an appropriation of this method and say, well, but we have our own issues to address. And I find it also something very interesting that liberation theology, and as many as these other, what we now call contextual theologies, have made use of other disciplines, other sciences, in order to better understand society. What is to see? What is to discern or to judge? And what is to act? Well, in order to better understand what is going on, in order to see a problem, in order to come to awareness or consciousness about the situation, it is necessary to interpret the reality in which we are inserted. I need to understand, you know, the ground upon which my feet are standing. And that's why liberation theology was, I think, one of the first contextual theologies to make use of sociology, of economics, of anthropology. I know other theologians have done so beforehand. Paul Tillich, for instance, he was a great theologian. He did a similar dialogue with cultures, with art, with psychology. But pretty much an isolated theologian. Why liberation theology has such a strong expression is because it's not only one single theologian doing this theology, but it represents a whole wave in which theology is done. And I think that is part of the contribution that liberation theology has had. Of course, in the 70s, it was very strong the use also of a Marxist theory of society, and trying to explain how is it possible that the society continues to live when there are so many that have and so many that do not have. When you have a society in which there is a very small group of people that owns the means of production, that owns the land, that decides about the political future of the country, and that so many simply comply with what is said. And of course, I think it was the beginning, it had many shortcomings, but in many ways, I think it was a starting point for a whole new chapter in the way theology is made.
Well, I was just going to say, 20 years ago or later, or even before that, Tom Helder Camara came to Milwaukee, and he was at a peace rally, a big event where hundreds of thousands of people came. And then the next day, he, at the invitation of our archbishop, he spoke in a park. It was very cold. He was very uncomfortable. But they put the rostrum up there, and I think his nose just barely made it. Yeah. So they had to get something to put him on. Both of us had experience in El Salvador with base communities,
yeah,
and have seen how they use what they call liberation theology, where they, you know, and try to interpret and use scripture to back up, you know, what God is telling them they ought to do.
Uh-huh.
And we were amazed. We were at one place where they had a whole group that met regularly, and it included all the people who did all the special jobs. And when you listen, of course, it was through an interpreter. We don't speak Spanish. But it sounded like we were at a college with all kinds of professors talking about the way they did things, healthcare and all these other things, you know. And we really were so impressed by these people who probably had no education, if any, you know, maybe a couple of grades. And there they were conversing like college professors about all these various things, you know, that were going on in their community. It was very impressive.
Yeah.
Don Heller was on a trip across the United States, and they filmed it. It was called Excuse Me, America.
Are you familiar with that?
Have you heard of that?
No.
No? Oh,
it was wonderful. And what he was saying very gently was, Excuse me, America, you are so rich, and things look so good here, but these things are not right. And so we visit a black community, and he was out with Cesar Chavez in California.
Just all over.
It was about an hour long, and we used it ourselves in for a church retreat.
Yeah.
Because it was another, eye view of our country. And when you're right in the midst of it, you don't see your own flaws, you know?
Yes. Yeah. About the Christian based communities, I find I've worked with Christian based communities 2 years ago. We just have the 10th nationwide assembly of Christian based communities in Ilhéus, in Bahia, that's in northeast Brazil. And I think it's one of the countries where Christian based communities still go very strongly in spite of the let me put it politely, the lack of interest of the Roman Catholic Church in this theology, I have to put it very politely, because you see, Dom Helder Câmara, he was substituted by a rather conservative bishop, and very much when he, Dom Helder, to show, talking about, you know, how one's personality affects also one's ministry, so he had this big bishop's chair, and one of the poor men had come for a conversation with him, and he was quite intrigued by that chair. And the elder said, well, you know, you think an archbishop's chair is any different from a regular chair, you know, just sit on it and try it out. So he let this poor man sit on the chair, and, you know, of course, he saw there was no big difference whatsoever with any other chair. But, you know, that sensitivity. And the substitute of Dom Helder Câmara, there was in a big manifestation that there was the Christian-based communities were making with the labor unions and going to City Hall, and then they stopped in front of the archdiocese. And the first thing that the archbishop had done was call the police. So you see a different approach.
What are some of the scriptural bases for liberation theology?
Well, I wanted to talk just briefly about the Christian-based communities. Maybe the biblical basis for it is really the New Testament sense of the first communities that had everything in common. These were very poor people, and they shared what they had, the little that they had, very much down to earth, you know, concerned with, like in Acts, about the diaconical work, the service that is done to others, and how the Christian faith has a very strong relationship also to the well-being of bodies, and not only to saving souls. In that, I want to show in one of his poems how the concept of church is not the hierarchical church, you know, the church as the Vatican sees it, but the church as the body of Christ. And I think that has to do also with Paul's, it's a very Pauline understanding of church. And if I can just sum it up in one of his poems, maybe I can try better this way. He says, so you think that because of her weaknesses, Christ will forsake her? The worse his church and ours is marred by our failures, the steadier he will support her with his tender care. He could not deny his own body. I mean to say that Christ's presence can be felt more strongly among the poor than it will be felt in the cathedral downtown. So he has made quite obvious that he stands in the side of those who are, in fact, outcast of society, because that is the place where Jesus walked himself. Jesus was not walking the way of the palaces and the high road. He really went to walk. I mean, his sandals got as dirty as ours get, you know, from walking on dirt roads and fishing boats. I mean, that's not the life of a prince or somebody from the court. This is the life of a very simple person, somebody who is working class, somebody who is very concerned with the well-being of those around him, and somebody who affirms life and life in abundance. And so I think it's a whole rereading of the stories in light precisely of that solidarity that Jesus himself had with those who are outcast. Of course, what the church has done and the critique that liberation theology does is the attempt to spiritualize everything. So we are only concerned with saving souls. It doesn't matter if the body or human bodies are under torture. But the affirmation that the message of Jesus needs to relate to the here and now, there needs to be a difference, I think is very empowering. And I think it's empowering to the congregation as the people were hearing him. And in another poem, he puts it this way. He says, "Put your ear to the ground and listen. Hurried, worried footsteps, bitterness, rebellion. Hope hasn't yet begun. Listen again. Put out feelers. The Lord is there. He is far less likely to abandon us in hardship than in times of peace." And I think it has to do also with a whole idea of suffering and sacrifice. You know that when Christianity came to the Americas, when Columbus first got lost and and so found America, or when Pedro Álvares Cabral discovered Brazil, Christianity came to our continent with the sword in one hand and the cross in the other hand. And the church was always there to justify, to bless whatever action the crown had taken. So whether it was to take into captivity the indigenous population, whether it was bringing slaves from Africa, whether it was, the uneven distribution of land. All of these things were understood as being a sign of Christendom. And Pablo Richard, he writes about this very well. He understands the notion of Christendom as the attempt to save humanity through baptism and by converting everybody to Christianity. So the concern about saving souls, of everybody having to become Christians. And that was a baptism of fire. So that is the tradition of Roman Catholicism. And it was wrongly interpreted what is said in the New Testament, that to follow Jesus is to carry Jesus' cross. So it was understood that if people would have be tortured, punished, if they were abused physically, the quicker their soul would be elevated and then they would become better Christians. And I think that's the idea of suffering that is imposed on others to the benefit of those who are the elite, those who are the rulers. And what the liberation theologians are saying, and the experience you have had in El Salvador confirms that with the Jesuit priests who were assassined by the military regime, is that suffering, in the same way as with Jesus, may come as a consequence of an option that you make. If it is a preferential option for the poor, in this case, you will, in your option, you are automatically speaking from the underside of history. You are questioning and challenging things, because the simple fact that you say, well, the poor people are entitled to rights. They ought to have access to the same goods as everybody else. They are all children of God. And affirming the dignity of human life, also the dignity of those who are living in the slums, those who are living in the streets, those who live in the garbage dumps, who live from collecting that and eating that food. That means affirming God's presence in their midst. And that, of course, created a lot of problems for liberation theologians, because many pastors, many priests, many people who were identified with the Christian based communities were persecuted, were tortured, were killed. And in some ways, like the Jesuit priests and the two women who were working for them in the Universidad Católica, UCA, in El Salvador, in such a violent manner to also make a statement, to frighten everybody else who could go down and question that. So it's in his sensitivity, he also addresses that and how God's presence is there even in times of pain, of despair, persecution, as the experience that we have had in our country. He says, go down into the plans of God. Go down, deep as you may. Fear not for your fragility under that weight of water. Fear not for life or limb. Sharks attack savagely. Fear not the power of treacherous currents under the sea. Simply do not be afraid. Let go. You will be led like a child whose mother holds him to her bosom, and against all comers in his shelter. I think the experience of being tortured, which is something that maybe most of you will never experience in your lifetime, in having all of your rights taken from you, and you are seen as an enemy to your own country by the simple fact that you question the status quo, needs to be explained in a spirituality, in a faith belief as well. It's not only an ideological position. I mean, there needs to be, in liberation theology, there is a very strong component in the social movements themselves, drawing from Christianity and saying, well, somewhere, somehow, some way, there is an alternative to this. And the strength is carried precisely from Christianity. And in trying to identify the church in its original passion for justice, for peace, for life abundant, finding the source for transformation nowadays. Now, interestingly enough, the Christian-based communities during the military dictatorship were one of the few places where people could actually gather, because part of military dictatorship was people could not meet. Like what we were doing here would be considered highly illegal. I mean, we would be busted. I mean, everybody would be brought to jail, because had we asked for an authorization to meet together? No, we haven't. So, okay, everybody to jail. And then, you know, that all the bureaucratic procedures that involve, you know, going to the police and everything. So the church was the only place that had in the beginning this this status, well, we have to meet weekly, you know, for Bible studies, for singing, for prayers. And so the church was the only place where the state was not there to interfere. And the church, therefore, was the only place that any challenges could be raised in a safe way. So the Christian-based community especially became the place where leadership was developed, where alternative modes of society were dreamed of, where people were just looking for a safe space. And also the church, especially liberation theologians, have helped many people to flee the country as people were persecuted. How many of our leaders had to flee the country and seek for exile first in Argentina and then in Chile, and then they went to Mexico. And as in these places too, successively military dictatorships were put into place. Of course, they had to flee somewhere else. They went to Europe, they went to Canada, some came to the United States, but very few, of course, because the connection between the United States government and the military dictatorships was very, very clear from the beginning. That was the close connection between these two. Any other question or comment?
I have a comment, because Tom Helder really lived what he spoke about. He gave up his palatial residence and actually moved into the residence that was set aside for the Archbishop. You know, he just refused to live there. He moved into the community. You know, I've read a lot of Buff, and I see where he was silenced by the Vatican for some of that was liberation type things too. You know, that he was silenced and he could not know. He at the present time, I still think he cannot write. And
Leonard Boff has since left the priesthood, and so he is like any other regular Roman Catholic and can do what he wants. So I just met him a couple of days before coming here. We had a consultation of liberation theologians and feminist theologians, and he and many other theologians, we were quite pleased in seeing how much more free he is. See, what happened then? If in the 1960s the Vatican opened itself up to social issues, by the 80s the doors were slowly getting closed. And then Leonard Boff wrote this great book, which is translated into English as Church, Charisma and Power. Is that how it is? Yeah? In Portuguese is Igreja, Carisma e Poder. So he wrote this book in which he critiqued, of course, and he compared two models of church. On the one hand, you had the Christian-based communities, which were very much in tune, I mean, trying to live out Jesus' message, and very democratic, and a participation of everybody, and women and children, and very much oriented toward developing programs of health and nutrition and lively celebrations. And then there was this other church, very, you know, stifled in its structure, preventing women's ordination, preventing and defending celibacy, but very much, you know, in a top-to-bottom order. And he critiqued that one. Well, didn't take him long, he was silenced. Mm-hmm. So he had to keep silence for a whole year. The Vatican imposed that on him. And after that, he was he maintained his silence for that period of time. But then things got ever more complicated for him in the Roman Catholic Church. So now he is a university professor, and he has left the priesthood. But he continues to be a theologian and a philosopher. And I think it's a bit of a contradiction, because whereas the Roman Catholic Church, at least in Brazil, is more and more ecumenical. The Roman Catholic Church belongs to the National Council of Churches. There are many initiatives that we are doing together. For instance, there's a bilateral dialogue between Roman Catholics and Lutherans proposing hospitality, Eucharistic hospitality, something that we are practicing already, so we can go to each other's, participate in communion together. And whereas this is going on, also you see some documents like Dominus Jesus being put out, where it says only salvation is a thing only the Roman Catholic Church. And so there is some contradiction going on there. But the experience of this assembly 2 years ago, where about 10,000 people were brought together in this assembly of the Christian-based communities in Brazil, showed to me at least very vividly how strong this movement still is. Unfortunately, didn't get any coverage of the mass media in Brazil, and apparently, you know,
nothing up here either.
Well, much less here. Something that I asked the other day, and very much the involvement nowadays, the political leaders, if you ask them, labor unions, neighborhood associations, and in political parties, people who are less likely to identify with the military regime or with the elite, many of them will say that their school was in the Christian-based communities. Most of these leaders started in the church, and then they moved on to civil society. And I think it's a good service that the church does, you know, in preparing leaders for the society as a whole. Did you want to share something from your experience?
In about 85, my son and I were in Mexico and Nicaragua, and I remember a woman in one of the base Christian communities who, we asked her style, and she said, well, most of us have to ride buses, and the buses are terribly full, and the buses are in terrible condition. So we sit on a seat that's supposed to have springs, and the springs stick through, and they tear our clothes. And she said, we used to put up with that for years. And now I start talking to the lady beside me, and I say, do you know this spring sticking out and it's tearing my clothes? Is this right? Is this what our government should be about? Let's raise a bus. And so she said the bus would sort of get activated, and then she'd get off that bus and get on another bus and find a seat that also had a spring out of it, and it'd start to stand on it. She said, you've got to start agitation someplace, because this is that seeing and discerning and saying, I'm going to say something, and pretty soon we'll change the community. Mm-hmm. The other thing that we saw, we went on Sunday in Managua to a base Christian community, and later that day we went out and watched Obando y Bravo in his palatial cathedral out in the country. Mm-hmm. And in the little community in town, of course, it was a small group gathered, and we sang hymns, and we had a good conversation around with the priest and so forth. And then went out to Obando y Bravo's parish, and he came out and he stood, and they robed him from beginning to end into about 7 different robes, each one grander than the next, and his hat, and the same text was preached about at both services. And I tell you, it was a joke to go to listen to Obando y Bravo talk about the same text, which had great potential, and he never hit a thing that was meaningful. Mm-hmm. And it was quite an eye-opener to me. When you have there were cars, all fancy, rich cars around Obando y Bravo's church, and a lot of fancy dressed people, and all wealthy. They all came from a long ways around to listen to the bishop. Yeah.
At the last Christian basement, the assembly, there was in the at the beach, there was this huge celebration to show you how much more ahead the Christian basement is than the hierarchical church based on the Christendom model. And in one of the closing worships, the final blessing was given by a Lutheran female pastor, one of my former students. She was giving the benediction at the end. There was the Roman Catholic bishop, a male bishop, of course. There was the Afro-Brazilian mother of saints. She is like the spiritual leader of the Afro-Brazilian Candomblé religion. And another woman, from the indigenous community as a wise woman, we call Pajé. So these 4 were giving the final benediction to the assembly. And it was really moving because, can you imagine, I mean, they represented the whole country in terms of religion, in terms of inter-religious dialogue, in affirming this unity. But of course, as Christian-based community, there is such a freedom, but I did not want to be around the next day, you know, when the news came to the Vatican, because how can that be, you know? that's not acceptable. I mean, that type of thing needs to go very much according to the protocol. But the Christian communities, they do have that freedom. I remember as I was doing my internship, and I said that I was another experience. I was doing my practical work because I was a student of theology and I was going to be ordained. I wasn't yet, but I was going to be ordained. I was going to be a pastor, which was the equivalent of Roman Catholic priest. And the assembly, the community had its yearly assembly, and there were maybe 300 people gathered at this assembly. And then we had Bible study, we had talked about what the priorities were for that village. And one of the women stood up and she said, very much like you said, well, now we have a woman here, and she is a student of theology, and she's going to be a pastor. Look what God has sent to her. Yeah. I mean, isn't this something wonderful? I think we should have that in our church too. So they voted for it, and the whole community was unanimous for women's ordination in the Roman Catholic Church. And then another woman said, well, how do we go about doing that? And they said, a letter to the bishop isn't enough, because the bishop is already sitting in the midst of us here, and I think he can't decide. I think we are going to send a letter to the Pope and let him know our opinion about this. So they wrote a letter. They wrote a letter, and everybody, you know, who could sign, signed. Otherwise, they would just put their thumb on it. It's like, yeah, mm-hmm. They wrote a letter to the Pope saying, we find this an interesting idea. You know, go about changing it. It's like, and I found that fascinating, because it's like that. Once people discover the capacity to change situations, you know, then and the strength that there is in the many coming together, things can change. Things can really change. Yeah.
You know that there was a real strong, a negative reaction to liberation theology here, especially among conservative groups.
Yeah.
And based upon the fact that the association with Marxism,
yeah,
and also the fear or the premonition that carried to an extreme of the people would be induced to take arms.
Yeah, and in many places that did happen, indeed. Yeah, if you see like the Nicaraguan Revolution, yeah. And I think I always critique that, because I used to live in this country 15 years ago when many of these things were going on. So I lived in Brazil, I have experienced how it was here, and I experienced it again in 1990 onwards, when I moved back to Brazil. And I find there is some truth to the critique, and I think it needs to be taken full-heartedly. Yes, liberation theology does make use of categories of social analysis, and Marxist theory is one of them. As it does make use of anthropology, as it makes use of Freud, as it makes use of any of these other theorists. And I think that we are indebted. I mean, these people are thinkers, and they shape our way of perceiving society. So I think that is something that needs to be acknowledged. Now, there, especially as you are pointing out, the negative commentaries that liberation received was because it did have political power. And as soon as religion could touch or question any of the power of the status quo, then it was seen as negative. But in 500 years, when it served to blast the status quo, it was okay. So I find that deeply hypocritical. It says, yeah, if it benefits us, then it's acceptable. If it questions us, then we need to undermine it. And I find it, you know, especially in with all the military intervention that the U.S. government had practiced, you know, in the 80s, in the beginning of the 90s, in Central South America, you know, and different versions we are seeing today, if it isn't also blessing of Christian weaponry on behalf of the killing that is done. And I think that needs to be acknowledged. It's not, it's presenting the two sides of a different fact. And I think it needs to be addressed honestly. If it benefits us, then it's okay. If it doesn't, then it's faulty.
Well, I was just going to add to that is that anything that threatens the hierarchy in this country as well as in Brazil, I'm sure, is a threat, and it has to be talked down. So they could see nothing good about liberation theology because it was doing that. It was threatening this kind of a church with a hierarchy that imposed belief on everybody rather than from down here, which rose up. And that's exactly why they could not give it any blessing, because it threatened their own structure.
Yes. And what I find also important to say is that nowadays, unfortunately, the Roman Catholic Church has played into that rule, into that game as well. I used before the example of the replacement of the Dom Helder Câmara, but if you see the replacement of all bishops identified with liberation theology, all of them have systematically been replaced by very conservative bishops. Meaning to say that, yes, Ratzinger at the end is the one that rules, you know. it's very strong in how the cardinals in Rome play out, you know, that those new appointments.
So do other denominations have an influence so much in Brazil and Latin American countries?
Well, in the last census, Roman Catholicism is still the religion of the majority of the people all over Latin America. But there is a very interesting fact about our culture and parts of our history too, is that most people identify with more than one religion. It's not people, Brazilians particularly, we do not lack faith. We have, I think, too much. We even go to more than one church. There's no contradiction in you being Roman Catholic and going to this spiritistic sect, or if you're going to a Afro-Brazilian, or you being, somewhat Buddhist at the same time. I mean, you're Catholic, but then you do all of this at the side. You know, it's very particular. And I think that's a dream come true for any person who wants to study anthropology or religious anthropology, because it's fascinating. So even though Roman Catholicism is the religion of the majority, you will see that, especially in the historical Protestant churches, the issue of ethics, the critique against the corruption in government, the issue about the common good, issues about citizenship, which is one of the main themes that we are discussing in the churches, because for you...
In our country, it's a county.
Yeah, and I think that for you who have gone abroad and you have one foot in one reality in your country, and you have put a foot in another country, the basic presupposition that you have that the state is here to assure my well-being, you know, I'm a citizen here, I have rights, that premise is gone in Latin America. The state is there to assure the rights of those of the elite. Don't presume things will work for you. To the contrary, presume that they won't work for you and try to find a way around it. and that's why the churches are so important in bringing about any change in people's lives, because the church has that place, that opportunity to raise consciousness about situation, to point out the inadequacy of things, and simply questioning and raising questions and saying, why is it that we need to sit on a bench that, you know, has is putting holes into our clothes? It's like, why should we put up with this crap?
Yeah.
And the notion of citizenship has, in the past 10 years, been like one of the catapults for political participation. You will see thousands and thousands and thousands of people on the streets and say, well, you know, we pay our taxes, you know, where does the money go? And asking for transparency in politics and transparency in the budgets. And so I think it's an opportunity, but as I say, liberation theology has had a great contribution in Latin America, but it also had its shortcomings. And one of them was since the emphasis was given so strongly on the issue of the poor, that it put aside other issues, for instance, the issue of culture, how to deal with Afro-Brazilians, how to deal with the indigenous population, how to deal with women, how to deal with homosexuality, how to deal with physical differences. And that was one of its shortcomings. And I think that is why we are talking about a new generation of liberation theology that takes the face of black theology, indigenous theology. For instance, the Aymaras in Bolivia have an excellent liberation theology that is called indigenous Aymara theology. So how you translate the Aymara culture into a understanding of Christianity that can, you know, be appropriate to that particular context. And this is some of the things that I will talk to more. So if you come back,
I will. Same time tomorrow?
No. Tomorrow it's at,
I think you're
at 5.
5.
5. Tomorrow it's at 5. On 5 o'clock. So okay. Yeah. So tomorrow you have the late dinner. I won't have the late dinner. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And let me say this. I think it's quite moving to somebody to come from a different country and see that there is a genuine interest in dialogue and in learning and establishing bridges, which is, I think, what we do when we exchange our lives and the opportunity of getting together. So thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you.